Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance and force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.
Hello, good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone, and especially to our friends from Far East. Good night.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee on Fridays. Great to see you, even if we don't see you, we suppose you are there. So welcome to the show today. And for those who don't know what is impact investing and sustainability, let's just very briefly talk about that. When we talk about impact investing, what do we mean? We mean that it's investment in businesses which have an underlying mission to solve one or several sustainable development goals, addressing social and environmental challenges of our planet. And those businesses are very innovative, they use technology, they are scalable, and of course, they are financially self-sustainable. So we are talking about investments, not philanthropy and not charity here. What is the difference to sustainable investments? Sustainable investments usually use ESG criteria or environmental social governance criteria in order to select best in class businesses or companies. And usually they are listed on stock exchange. Nowadays, unfortunately, almost everyone calls himself or herself a sustainable business. Microsoft, Apple, Unilever, and so on. Well, fine, right? So they are sustainable. But do they really make a big difference in our world? Do they really create impact which changes people's lives? Right. So here, unfortunately, those companies do not have the underlying mission per se, but they're still focusing on profit. Of course, we need them because as a huge corporation, you can create tremendous impact on thousands, millions of people's lives. Right. But we need to understand what is what in order to take the right action. So here, when we talk about impact investing, we talk about deep impact. Which changes lives and which changes lives for better, of course, for better. And what we want is to help solving sustainable development goals defined by United Nations. I hope this explains this briefly, what we are talking about. And now, Ben.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much for this very technical definition, Svetlana. So, and exactly this is the point where we also educate a lot of entrepreneurs and businesses all around the world on what is impactful business, how to put impactful business into it, and just complete, we very coincidentally completed a course yesterday. So if you're interested, keep an eye on the website, which will be shown just now, I think. We will send you also the next information when we do. And the topics which we cover is like impact investment, what is impact investment and what is an impactful business. What we also cover is how you set up your business, or if you're already an existing business, how to grow. SDGs and impact, how to incorporate these processes in your business and business life, and processes and structuring, because the business structure is extremely important, especially when you're seeking impact investment. Fundraising strategy, which is very important nowadays, and also because a lot of funds are coming available, investment process, and we also teach how to make the perfect investment pitch at the course. So today we are standing for the seventh time in this business family TV show. So I think, and today the role will be a bit different. So Svetlana will take over from here.
Yes. And I mean, your input was not less technical than mine. So now let's go to the pleasant moment when we welcome our guest, Prince Michael from Liechtenstein. And I'm really excited to today's program, as Ben will be also on the other side. So I will be interviewing two amazing and very interesting, very experienced men. So looking forward to that. Let's welcome our guest, Prince Michael from Liechtenstein. Big applause for you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me here, and welcome to everybody.
Thank you. Michael, before we start the show today, could you please share a little bit of your background and a little bit about yourself, so our audience knows where you're coming from as a royal family, of course, but something more personal.
Maybe on my background, I've basically always been an entrepreneur. When I started my business career, working for about 10 years for Nestle, the food business all over the world, quite a long time also running businesses in Africa. And then I developed a financial company in Liechtenstein, which my family is now the majority owner, which actually has as purpose, we call it wealth preservation. We are mainly working with family businesses, trying to help them and to find structures to keep their assets, their businesses over generations. It is pricing generation giving, a very sustainable issue, not only environmentally, but also socially and financially. And you know, it's very important to have consistent businesses. And I would say that the family businesses are the most sustainable business in all aspects, which we have. I then developed, because I was not very happy with the situation of information, I developed a network and a publishing work and consulting work, which we call Geopolitical Intelligence Services. There we run a network of about 180 experts worldwide to give us background information and future scenarios. Mm-hmm. Svetlana, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, it was a bit breaking. Was it 180? You say
180. Yeah,
180 experts. Okay.
180, and giving background informations and future scenarios. These are all people who have great experience, great knowledge, and also themselves a good network. And then finally, I did also some impact work. Well, I think also any company you're running and creating is an impact work. But I did also, I was very interested, like other ones, in the problem of health. Mm-hmm. And we have seen that basically our society, we have an aging society, we will not be able anymore to meet the health costs. Problem is also, most of the healthcare system is actually a sick care system. And so
yes,
we thought,
absolutely, I agree with that.
Do something in the preventive health, sort of to prevent people getting sick, and mainly also to delay, to increase the health span, not necessarily the lifespan, but the health span of people, and delaying or avoiding the entrance of these age-related chronic diseases like cancer, cardiovascular, diabetes, etc. And this is also the place where I am now. It's called Longevity Center. And the first one we did was, I'm now in Warsaw. I normally live in Liechtenstein, Switzerland, but I'm now in Warsaw, and where the first center was established.
Amazing. But you'll talk a bit about this impactful side, of course, later. because it's very interesting to know about your impact and what exactly you are doing there. Thanks for sharing with us. Another question, just very briefly, who can join these geopolitical intelligence services? Is it possible to join, or how is it working?
To get the information, we do two things. The one thing is we are publishing it on a subscription method, which you can find on the internet. Mm-hmm. There's a subscription, and then you get basically 5 reports a week, subscription basis. But we also do consulting work with our experts, which is mostly for international businesses.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. Now to Ben. Mr. Ben Banerjee.
Thank you. Today I'm on the other
side. Welcome to the show. And I wanted to ask you to share your background on predicting events, because I know you can predict events almost like a magician, to say what's going to happen in the future. And a lot of times, actually, it really happened.
Till now, I have quite a good background. So it's funny. So it started in the school time when I was still in the schools. I wrote an essay somewhere in 1982 when I wrote that Cold War will not be a war between US and USSR, which in that time was completely nobody believed it, because we all were in the heat of the Cold War. And also the collapse of USSR was imminent. So anyway, fast forward in 1992. I wrote an email wrote a letter to President Clinton over the consequences of some of his policies. I won't go into detail now, but this resulted me in getting very close to the U.S. administration from that time onwards. So I became also member of a couple of esteemed think tanks like the East-West Institute and things like that. And I have made quite a lot of, I have a track record of making, don't want to bore the audience with that. But few of the most important ones were that I wrote about also the impact of migration on the European societies. This was in the begin 2000, when it was still not that deep yet. The consequences of the effect of the result of the Arab Spring, the removal of Gaddafi from Libya, climate change, migration. I have spoken all around the world on this topic. I mean, not climate change migration, but climate change related migration, Europe, Ukraine, Iran crisis. That's how I also know Prince Michael very well. We have had a lot of discussions on this, including one of my favorite topic, that is Brexit. Spoke about it more than 7 years before Brexit happened. So, and I just wanted to add a short story I had when I was 21 years old. I don't know if many of you know Simon Wiesenthal. He created the Wiesenthal Center. In 1992, I had a debate with him. He was a grand, old, extremely wise man, and I was a complete idiot student sitting in front of him. But I told him that under the present world situation, democracy is not right for all the cultures, regions of the world. It's not the magic medicine. Mm-hmm. And of course, he completely disagreed, and he told me something which I don't want to quote now. But somehow it seems I turned out to be right, at least in that case. So, yeah, that's short background of myself.
Thanks. Thank you. Maybe a few words about myself. So those who don't know me, I'm now completely into impact investing. But before, I was in traditional finance, banker, and nowadays, I'm teaching at the universities, acting as a speaker. We have our own TV show, as you see. We have educational programs. I also established a couple of companies, non-profit and for-profit. So, and the mission is, of course, to help social entrepreneurs to achieve social environmental impact. And this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. Okay, but it's not about me today. It's really about your intellectual abilities to talk about the future and the present. So let me just ask you the first question. How, to Prince Michael first, how do you see that the world will look like in 2030? So in 10 years, how do you see our world will look like?
You know, this is a bit of a tricky question. It's easier to talk from 30 years of now because there will be less measure. But I think we can think about different scenarios. And if we look, and we have to look at it from what is technology doing, what is politics doing, what is the economy doing, what
if you can go briefly through all these steps, not like how do you see that? What's going to happen?
Well, I think, and I will do a few things. I think we will, unfortunately, will not go further on the way of globalization, but rather on the way of fragmentation. Mm-hmm. And we will have, probably, we might see, with all the caveats on that, political fragmentation, because we had now about 30 years of a clearly sort of Pax Americana and hegemony of the U.S. principles after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, mm-hmm. other powers are coming up, and we have a real conflict brewing up between not only a trade conflict between China and the United States. Yep. This is there. There's the old hegemon and the new power which wants to be hegemon. It has nothing to do with Donald Trump. That started already before, mm-hmm. and I think it's a very natural development. China is afraid of being contained, so they want a certain fragmentation. That's why also this double circulating economy becoming more autonomous, getting out of the dollar system in monetary ways, and also becoming independent technologically. And the other countries will have to adapt to that, and to a certain extent also to make decisions, which I think Europe at the moment has a big problem. There's also a big problem for the for certain Asia's powers, from Japan down to the Philippines and the ASEAN thing. They are afraid of the political assertion of China and becoming too dependent on them. So they see the United States as their ally, but on the other side, China is their biggest trading partner. Mm-hmm. So this is the one side. The other side, there will be a technological conflict, I think also a fragmentation. And we see it already, you know, with Huawei, the 5G issue. We have it also a bit on the vaccine issue now. Mm-hmm. So I think we will see there quite some fragmentation. I see also very interesting developments happening in Africa, a big issue for Europe, mm-hmm. because it is a direct.
You mean migration here, or what exactly?
Say it again.
Do you mean migration from Africa, or what?
Well, I think, you know, the migration is one side, but the other side is, how is Africa developing? Who will be the players, etc.? Mm-hmm. And you know, there are a lot of interest there. It's actually Europe would be in the best position to help them, and could offer the best solutions for Africa, but it doesn't do it. Mm-hmm. But there is an influence from China. I think the most efficient one now are the Turks there, but they are too small to mm-hmm. really develop Africa. So it will be, because we must not forget that basically Africa is the richest continent in the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so what about the financial sector, maybe, Michael?
A number of challenges and interesting developments. And I think the time, but I think these are some of the main ways. Maybe another thing which will be very important for Europe will be the relationship with Russia. Mm-hmm. We are doing a lot of, the West is doing a lot of mistakes with treating mm-hmm. Russia. I completely agree. The whole sanction policy is wrong. So certainly, well, I don't agree with what happened in Ukraine, obviously, and it's not. But the sanction policy, and I think the West would have great interest to be in good relationships with Russia. And I think this is also one side which is also very important, how this will be handled.
Michael, what about financial sector? How do you see financial sector, especially Switzerland is very much into financial sector, so how do you see it developing in the next year?
Well, this is, I would say, it's the most tricky one. We have, for the financial sector, we have, I think, a lot of part of the financial sector and the players there are quite outdated. There's a lot of reform necessary. But we have to see two things. We have to see the monetary policy in general, which I think is very dangerous at the moment. There's too much money around. There's a very, I think, a nearly irresponsible policy by central banks and a debt policy by the government. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite irresponsible. So the value of the money is in danger. And I don't know how that will end, this policy, but you know, we have times, let's say, where the money policies and money was blown up artificially. We had it in France in the early 18th century, which finally led to the French Revolution. We had that, and I can't see how that will end well. I think the modern monetary theory is, let's say, a witch doctor, a hopeful thing. But I think there is also technology coming in. And I think this is, I think that the financial system will reorganize itself totally. I think it will go through a bigger crisis than now. But there are possibilities in future. That's why it's important to have good investments, which goes also in the sector of impact investments, and also probably new ways of payment systems, of money, etc. But it's but I think we will there start pretty much from scratch.
Yep. Okay. Thanks, Michael, for sharing. Very interesting. I hope the audience can follow. And now, Ben, the same question to you. How do you see the world in 2030?
I completely agree to Michael on all those points, because we have also had
this discussion. That's very easy. No, that's too easy.
Yeah, exactly. Especially about Russia and China. But I'll try to just keep focused on one point, and that's the economic point. What COVID has made us see that we can have all kind of predictions we want, but the nature of the environment has to throw one curveball, and our all production predictions disappear. Despite of all our knowledge, intelligence, the global economy shrank more than 4% last year. So this pandemics and the frequency of pandemics are getting faster. I don't know if you're aware. That last year we had two pandemics. The other one was very strong also, which happened in China. Luckily, it did not spring from animals to human. If it would have sprung, then we would have had, again, a major serious problem. It was contained with a complete, China had to reduce its swine population very significantly to control that pandemic. So we are getting this one after another coming, as Lord Attenborough also recently mentioned, because you had the swine flu, SARS, Ebola, now we have COVID, and God forbid if the next pandemic has the mortality of Ebola or something. I mean the mortality ratio, because COVID has a very, very low mortality ratio. So looking at all this, and then I look at the world leaders, and especially us, the enlightened West, I'm not very hopeful at this moment still how we are going to manage it. So I know that how the governments have acted on the pandemic for different countries is a debatable issue. In all countries, we can debate whether in India they did it right or not by stopping. You all must have read about what happened in India, then what happened in America, Europe. It has not been homogeneous. Every government has acted differently. But the economy has suffered and small businesses have been pushed under. If you look at just in New York, the Wall Street may be doing amazing, but there is so much bankruptcies and so many small and middle-class businesses have been hit. And somehow we forget that this is the backbone of most of the economies, whether we are talking about US, Europe, China, India, and they have been the most severely devastated by this pandemic. So I think in conclusion, I'll keep it short, otherwise, like Prince Michael said, we will be running out of time, is I think in the next 10 years, we will have more localization of the supply chain. So what Prince Michael mentioned very quickly, a kind of anti-globalization movement, which I think already has started and will just go further. I think COVID has basically accelerated it. Less use of a lot of fossil fuel-based industries, that's including aviation and all that. Production is going to become more, people are going to be more think better before going into production supply or production lines. Less exporting of dirty products and more control on investment. And I'm focusing mainly on the finance, and this will come later on during the discussion. The finance is going to be more and more regulated and more controlled. So at least that's what I just want to say for the moment.
Okay, we will see in 10 years. We have the recording now, so I'm really curious to see how it's going to be. Hope the positive predictions will be there, and not positive, hope you will find a way to figure it out. But let's go to the next question. And I mean, everyone knows about climate change. And I also want to ask you, Michael, how do you see the effect of climate change on the economy in the next 10 years, but also like how climate change will develop in 10 years? Will it be more or less? Like, how do you see, what is your belief about climate change? So a little bit share with us, how do you experience climate change and what is your predictions in this regard?
You know, climate always change, like nature is constantly in change. So I think these are issues where we have to adapt. Now, it's sometimes very difficult to forecast in which direction it's going. And we know if we look at the history of Earth, there was always a warming and a cooling, etc. Now, there is also the question, and I'm just talking a little bit, of man-made climate change. So it's very difficult to say what is man-made, what is not man-made, and there are very different opinions. And it's a very emotional scene.
What do you believe? You know, how much is it man-made? How much is it not man-made?
Yeah, not man-made.
This is what matters.
Yeah, and it has nearly become a religion, climate change, nearly a religion. But I think we have to adapt it. It's very clear. What a big challenge we have is to fight pollution and waste. And I would rather go in direction pollution and waste in activities to fight it than at climate targets, etc. Because sometimes, you know, the activities of the sun, they don't really look what the German government or the European Union or the United Nations are deciding. But we have to face it, and we have to face it in all parts of the economy and of politics, and areas in the world will change. I know it, you know, I'm also a bit involved in the forest industry. We have to see in Europe where the woodland is growing. There's more woodland than 50 years ago and more woodland than 100 years ago, but the type of trees will change. Mm-hmm. And we are looking, we have to work probably in future with a little bit a different type of trees. There will be, if we look at, for instance, Russia and Siberia, there we might have a lot more agricultural land there and produce it there. In other areas, there might be more problems. But in reality, We have to be very flexible because we don't really know whether there will be a global warming coming up or not, and how much it is. It is a big challenge. I think it's there are dangers, but there are also opportunities in there. And I think there it is really important not to be dogmatic, but actually being pragmatic and opportunistic. But still, always, we want to have clean air, we want to have clean water, we want to control emissions.
I completely agree. I mean, pollution and waste reduction is so important, you know. But then let me ask you a little bit personal question. How do you fight it on the personal level? Your waste reduction, pollution, what do you do as a person yourself?
You know, I think it. My life doesn't change very much. I told you, you know, our family always had forests. And the word sustainability comes out of forests. And if you look also, if you have a sustainable and efficient, long-term efficient business, you always try to minimize waste and et cetera. And pollution is also part of the waste. So we were already from childhood on, we were trained not to make too much waste, to try to use everything in certain ways. And I believe, and I do it that way, that not that I say, well, I should not fly in a plane because this is too much waste. But on a personal level, I think we are all pretty careful. Already my parents in the 1950s, they only bought cars which didn't use too much petrol. And at that time, you were even told to use more. So I think it, for me, it doesn't change too much.
Okay, well, that sounds interesting. Now, Ben, as you are such a climate change fan, it will be challenging to say your opinion on that.
Yeah. No, I think I agree to some of the parts of Prince Michael, but not all the parts, because till now the studies of the, I don't know, Michael, if you saw the last study of the scientists mentioned that the situation is far worse than we think it is, and especially it is man-made. It was a report published, I think in the UN, but I'll come to that later, that 68% of our wildlife is gone in the last 3 decades. And this is mainly because of the loss of habitats, wildlife trading, and pollution. And also Professor Bradshaw from Australia mentioned that the scale of damage and threat to the biosphere and life form is so great that it's difficult to grasp even for well-informed experts. And another scientist also mentioned that the mainstream is largely unaware of the extent of damage, and the world leaders need a cold shower as the current environmental conditions are far worse than we are made to believe or what we are reading about. And this there was a report published, I think, 2 weeks ago or something in Davos by the United Nations and climate expert. I can send it to you later. So, and that also says, and that says that we are used to more about thinking the last 10, 15 years that the climate change is going to be gradual. This report said, no, it will not be gradual. It will be sudden and it will be cataclysmic. Because in the Russia, you are having this permafrost, which is melting fast. And the moment it releases the methane, there will be a complete loss of ice on Earth, which will mean we are not talking about a gradual increase of seawater level with 20 or 30% by the end of the century. We are talking about a seawater level of increase of 30 meters within a week. And this will be unstoppable. So we are at that brink at this moment, according to these reports. And I think the financial sector also is waking up to the fact that many of their underlying assets are losing value very fast. They're either turning into stranded assets or they're turning into assets which they cannot do much with, especially fossil fuel-based industries. So already there is a gradual move I see of finance moving away from what I usually call brown industry. That's basically the tradition of the fossil fuel-based industries. And it is, the money is moving away and it is seeking new destination. This is also growing, this is kind of fueling the growth of the non-brown industry. Did you read the report? Not the report. It was a speech of Mark. What's his name? Mark Carney. He was the former governor of the Bank of England. When he warned that the loss of the asset value by climate change is so significant that it's going to trigger massive loss for the insurance companies, pension funds, banks. So already he's advising the governments, because he also advised the UK, because he's former, he's no more in the position. He advised the UK government in the COP25, I think last year or something, that the government should start putting up supervisory issues for insurance companies, pension funds, and things like that. So that's my opinion on the climate change issue.
Michael, could Ben convince you in some point, or what would you say to some point?
Well, I'm saying, just picking up the last thing, I think the pension funds are more in danger by the monetary policies at the moment, and by the demography, and by the climate change. I must say, but we could talk very long about it, I see it less alarmist than you do. Mm-hmm. I know we have to be careful, and I know we have to do certain things, but I'm not so alarmed with you. I think on the measures we agree with. We don't want more pollution. We don't want that. I'm a bit less at the moment alarmed by the.
By the reports.
What is going on? So I'm a bit more optimistic than you are.
I just read the scientific reports.
I think I'll join Prince Michael here on this view, as I'm also optimistic. And I mean, to make the change back, it's impossible. You know, we need to adapt to what's going on. We cannot really revert it, so we need to not to mess it up more than we already did. It's what I think. And we need to certainly also rely on the research, because a lot of many decades it was just ignored, even though all the data was there. And now we see that the prediction there back in time 30 years ago, they were actually right. But because of fossil fuel industry and so on, we just didn't pay attention to that. So indeed, humans, I don't know exactly to which part, but we contributed definitely to climate change. Okay, but then let's go to impact investing from here, as climate, of course, is also part of some impact investments. But as you, Michael, are more into preventive healthcare, and you started talking about it at the beginning, could you tell us a bit more about what are your activities there, and are you as investor, as your own company, so how it's happening and what's the impact that you're creating?
Well, I think in this issue of the healthcare, I came in actually more or less from also the macroeconomic side, because I saw the problems we are running in, which I talked before. Now, I would say in this area, I would say I'm more of an active investor. I have other companies which I'm running, but I'm in investing there, and I'm helping to develop. And the idea there is actually to make a full diagnosis of a person. And that starts with regular tests like blood, etc. But also taking very strongly in the lifestyle of the person, etc., into account. And there are checks not only which is the traditional ones but also checks on the posture, how do you walk, how do you live, etc. And then we put together, or the center puts together, a plan for the people, how they can have a healthy nutrition, how the lifestyle, because you know the important thing is, and what I had also to learn a lot, for instance, a lot on your health, the genetic influence is in average just about 20%. Mm-hmm. But the epigenetic, your environment, is about 80%. So you can do a lot by adapting your lifestyle. It doesn't mean that you have to live like an ascet, but
I know I'm also a yogi, so I kind of some people would consider me ascet.
And you have a nice diet, and it has also to be adapted again to how you live, because if you are traveling constantly, you can't have a very strict diet. So one has to find other things. But it's not, if somebody is really sick or has already a chronic disease, they have to go to the normal medicine. But it should be actually, the ideal thing is actually that ideal moment to do it is for everybody 20 years ago, 20 years before. But also now, when you are more than 60, as I am, it's not too late.
But could you share with us what is your lifestyle then in this regard?
Well, I think I have pretty much, I don't want to say always not too bad of a lifestyle. I always move a lot. I'm blessed because I don't like sweets. This is certainly a blessing. What is not so good, what they're telling me, that I like very much to drink wine and beer. So
I was just going to add it, that Michael so has I a was very told, good taste in wine.
I wasn't forbidden to that, but I was told that I should be maybe a bit more moderate on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So but just what is the benchmark is that they do the biological age, which is a benchmark, because if your biological age is lower than your chronological age, it is pretty good. But it has to be the right mixture, because it doesn't help you if your cardiovascular curricula is, if you're 60 and your cardiovascular is at 40, but your liver is at 90. So you have to balance that. But there are, you can have benchmarks through the biological age.
Mm-hmm. And as we have also a lot of projects of watching us, and they're all looking for funds, and usually when you ask them, when do you need your funds, it was yesterday, so they're all looking for funds, you know. Wanted to ask you, as an investor, how it's possible maybe to approach you, or what kind of project would you invest in? So just maybe a little bit of selection criteria for our audience who are projects in healthcare sector.
Well, I think what is the real growth sector we have to look at is the sector of preventive health and healthier lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the whole sector, if you want, which is very necessary, the sick care, let's say like cancer, etc., it's already very well covered by the biotech industry. And they need very heavy investments. It's extremely costly. But I think for a real impact investment, there will be a lot of ways of modern nutrition. There are also a lot of small companies having quite interesting programs for modern types of food and fresher foods, sort of in the nutrition. But there are also a lot of other things like in skin care, etc. So that there are quite a lot of possibilities which don't need these so heavy investments and so long-term way to return like you have in the pharmaceutical and in the biotech industry.
Mm-hmm. But I was asking also, like you said, you're also an investor. So some of the projects are looking for private investment, and maybe, I don't know in which amount you invest, maybe as a business angel. So how to approach you as an investor if some projects are seeking for the funds? Would you be willing also to consider certain type of projects? What type of projects would that be?
Well, I like, I like things which are very, I would say, quite hands-on and don't need big structures, and where you can also see that. And I don't believe, for myself, I have no interest of being a passive investor.
Okay.
I want to be also somehow active. Operationally involved.
I see. Wow, that's great. You know, I always admire people which are remaining active till the end. Yeah. I think we will do the same with Ben. Ben, yeah, I think you were a bit sad that I'm not asking you anything. So
No.
Could you also reply to the same question, like about impact investing? So what is your view on what Vice Michael was saying, or do you have any comments on that, or any input?
I agree to the sector, what Prince Michael is saying, especially it was also, I think nearly 20 years ago, I was also involved in it. In Dutch, we used to call them, I forgot the term, wealthy, healthy, elderly people, the whoppers, to make health centers for whoppers. In from Netherlands, we did a lot of projects in Spain and in Portugal, especially in the coastal area. So kind of integrating health and with the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So I agree to what Prince Michael is saying that regarding the sector. But what I speak on general about impact investment, I think it's very positive because it is the kind of sector which at this moment has relatively the least risk and the maximum growth potential, whether we are talking about fintech or health or agriculture, there's only growth potential. So that's very positive. And another thing is that there are not too many MNCs, I mean, multinationals involved or in this sector yet. I was reading somewhere, I saw this chart that in 1975s or in 1970s, most of the multinationals or MNCs had a lifespan of 60, 70 years plus. Today, most of the MNCs have a lifespan of 15 years. So, I mean, average lifespan. So it gives enough space and opportunity. And I again go back to the Mittelstand. I don't know how you say it in English, the small and medium enterprises, that they have now a kind of green field, especially in the emerging economies, especially in the also in the advanced economies. So there is a green field for these businesses to move because we still do not have too many, or to my knowledge, there is no MNCs yet in these fields. So that gives it a free space for innovation and business development. I'll stick it there.
Okay, before we continue, or Prince Michael, yeah,
can
you
I
want
add
to say
something to that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
In my opinion is, if you make an investment which doesn't have an impact, it's rather a speculation than a really long-term and good investment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is a strong statement. Yeah.
I think impact in investment is very important, that you have for every investment that it really has an impact, because only then you have a long-term sustainable investment.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Agree on that. Thanks for this remark, Michael. And before we go to serious questions, heavy ones, I wanted to take a few questions from the audience. And one is from to you, Michael, about Africa. So greetings for today. Do you think Africa Union will happen in future just like European Union? What's your opinion on that?
Well, I'm not so sure because, you know, the European Union, I think to one side, yes. I think I hope that Africa will develop to a free market without, let's say, tariffs and borders, sort of the internal market, which is also the big strength of the European Union. I believe less in the political union, mm-hmm. but I think when Africa, there's a plan there, this African Union, if the borders will fall, maybe not politically, but for goods and services, mm-hmm. capital and exchange of people, if that will fall, I think it will be a big advantage of Africa, and I know that there is also certain intentions to do that, but these things take time. But I hope it will develop that way, that there will be a free exchange of goods, services, people, and capital.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Ben, what do you think?
I have some experience with this quite a long time back. Remember, Prince Michael, this was, I think, I was busy with DRC to bring European knowledge, because what you mentioned is very correct, that Europe has the knowledge, the expertise, the technology to support Africa. And Africa has the assets and the projects which Europe can work in. So it's a win-win situation. But it was still very difficult, because one issue that still plays, I don't know how big role it still plays, is the post-colonial history. So Africans sometimes can get very emotional or about, they would rather do business with China than with Europe, because they have some kind of historical influence or historical, the taste added. And I think that is a kind of a disadvantage of Europe. Would you agree to that?
I would agree to that. And I think it will also not start with a big plan, because if we look at Europe, the whole thing started with smaller experiences. There was this community on coal and steel in the 1950s. There was the Benelux Agreement.
Yeah.
And so it started out actually on an agreement of the first six, and then it became bigger. So I could imagine that also in Africa, it might start and also with a more regional collaboration, and then getting larger on that basis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't, also just like Michael, I don't see this union coming too quick and too fast, and certainly not like you.
It took in Europe, it's also already going for 7 years.
A long time.
We have very strong opinion on
and
that.
It's still far from the goal.
Okay, then from the union, let's go to Italy. We have also interesting questions. Dear Ben and Prince Michael, I would like to know your opinion about the Italian management of migration from Africa. And the second part of the question is, moreover, how could you rely to the declaration you want us to worry about the end of the world when we are worried about the end of the week? What would you say? So the first part was about Italian management of migration from Africa. What is your opinion on that?
You want me to start on that?
Or shall I start?
Why don't you start? Why don't you start?
I can be much more... I think it's a serious case of mismanagement, but it's not only Italy, it involves the whole EU. We have had this problem. We saw this problem coming. We predicted this problem, and we did nothing about it. And even today, we have, as a European Union, it's a mess. We don't even know whether we apply the Dublin Treaty or we don't, once we want to apply it, once we don't want to apply it. So I have very different opinion about how it is being managed in Italy. And I'm sure that Italian government or the Italian authorities have their own logic or their own reasons for doing what they are doing. But somehow I don't see that. And also, I think the problem should be looked into. I think EU has also mentioned a couple of times this problem should be looked from the EU perspective, how EU is going to manage it, but not in the way that EU Commission is pushing it through by enforcing countries to fulfill their wishes. You can't enforce it. So in that way, I'm not a fan of governments of Hungary or Poland, but I think they have the full right to say, sorry, here we refuse to cooperate, like Hungary did. So EU Commission, I think, overstepped its borders by trying to enforce this thing. So it is a very complicated problem which has to be dealt by whole of Europe, but Europe has to think similar. And in this way, I think the same like Michael, EU is not an institution or organization which can think as one. It is still too much people having their own national ideas, national views, and still acting on it and working on it. So I think that was the most tactical answer I could go give on international TV. But Yeah, that's where I'll stop for the moment.
Michael, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, well, I think if we don't, and I'm not, I also say I don't want to talk only about Italy, but I think we stay on a very superficial bureaucratic level and not on a very fundamental level, and not starting why are people coming, mm-hmm. and what should we do with them? Mm-hmm. It can't be that simply people are coming and then we accept them, we put them in camps and we don't integrate them and don't let them to work. But this has also a bit to do with certain, I would say, an exaggerated political correctness in Europe.
Yeah, I completely agree.
It's maybe not very popular what I'm saying, mm-hmm.
yeah.
but actually when somebody arrives and we don't want to do, the receiving country, receiving people should be entitled to say, who are you and what do you want from us? Mm-hmm. And actually, and you know, in the migration, it is, you are coming as a guest. So if it says, well, I have a problem, I'm prosecuted, I don't have it, I want to come to your country, because I respect your system. It doesn't matter. I respect your system. I'm ready to adhere to this system. And I want to work and make my living there. If it is going, if we have an exaggerated welfare state, we have a problem. Mm-hmm. And then it comes also an anti-foreigner movement. Mm-hmm. And I'm sticking with one thing which Milton Friedman once said very, very clearly. He said, you can have immigration and you can have a welfare state. But immigration and welfare state together is a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think we have the problem there. I'm basically pro, I have nothing, and I think immigration is good and we need it in Europe because we're an aging, reducing population. But we should put these people to work. But if we have too high social standards or skill standards that they can't work, then we have a real problem.
Yeah, but Michael, mm-hmm. it's not only about high standards. Also in Switzerland, they're just not allowed to work even, you know? Because they could work, they are doctors, yeah. they have degrees, they could learn the language, they could integrate, they could work, but Switzerland doesn't allow them to work.
But that's what I mean with the standards. There is, for instance, points like too high minimum salaries, etc., that you don't want it, or you just don't allow them to work because there's such a long procedure. But I think this, we have, and that's what I meant, we are looking on a very superficial bureaucratic way on it, mm-hmm. and not really on the fundamentals.
Right. And what about,
that's it.
Yes, that's it. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't want to interrupt you guys. It's very interesting. Yeah. So please finish your sentences and expressions. About the second part of the questions, what would you say? Maybe just very briefly. So if you want us to worry about the end of the world when we are worried about the end of the week, what would you say to that?
I think this is... this is a fact, you know. We have also this pyramid of human necessities, and if you can't survive, you will not worry about. If you have to worry about how to survive the week, a 6 weeks horizon is already a long horizon, and mm-hmm. I think we have one problem. We are getting more and more a split between a very intellectual sort of self-named elite who are very worried about the end of the world and people who are in the daily life. And the communication between these two groups has become very difficult. And there are many of the political leaders who are living what is called the Cuba syndrome. They just have people around them who have the same opinion, and they don't listen anymore to the needs of the people. And this is why, you know, we don't have populist movements because people are bad or they're radical or they're extremists. We have the populist movements because the political elite and also the academic elite does not care sufficiently for the day-to-day problems of the population. And this is one of the largest political problems we have now. And COVID, at the short term, was quite good for the political elite because when there's a crisis, people like to have, even if it's a sign of stability. But we see it in Germany. First, Mrs. Merkel's approval rate went up strongly, and now it starts to drop again. So I think this problem is a real problem, and there I think the, let's say, intellectual elite will need to cater a lot more for the problems of the normal people. And we see it also, we care about the large companies, but the backbone, as Ben also said before, are the small and medium enterprises.
Absolutely. Ben, from your side?
I agree to what Prince Michael said, that there is a huge gap of communication between the so-called the elites and the people. This has resulted in a lot of movements, and which also worries me a lot. Even Brexit was indirectly one of the consequences of that, of the communication. The last time we were talking to Blair, he also mentioned as a kind of warning to the EU that don't overestimate your influence with the mass, because there is such a big gap. And this also what I noticed in Netherlands also, that and in EU now it has become a kind of face of Brussels. Brussels is a kind of representative of EU. So this gap, this communication has to be reinforced. There's a huge gap. And what COVID has also done, and what Prince Michael said about the breaking of the like of Merkel's thing, that people her approval rating went up and down. But COVID also, if I look at the numbers, the negative side is that the middle and the poor class were pushed down even further. And of course, more and more draconian measures were implemented on them. But the elites, especially the richest of the rich, the 1% of the world, became significantly richer. So COVID did not really balance the play field, or how do you say, level the play field. COVID basically made it even more slanted. So now we have a much bigger issue with much more frustration or economical inequality after 1 year of COVID than the year before. So that was my point. Curious what Michael thinks about it.
This is true. And, you know, the more money at low interest rates is pushed in the economy, the more the value of assets are increasing, and the more sort of artificial wealth is coming. So I think this increase in inequality is a little bit driven by the monetary policy, but it will explode. It's a bubble. So it's not a real
when
inequality,
do you think it will explode,
but it's a bubble.
Michael, when do you think it will explode?
I have no idea. You know, this is
all the financial people would be listening right now. Actually, what do you think, Michael, about transformation of Wall Street? I don't know if you've seen, they actually put a new slogan instead of greed is good, green is good. And they also created a new logo where bull and bear are holding our earth very carefully, and Wall Street became green. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think very much about these things. You know, there were so many slogans. I have lived through these last 30 years, so I think one has to stay rational. I think one of the important things is to keep simply common sense. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And not listen to slogans. I think common sense is the most important things there. And whether a green is good, and what does green mean, etc. So.
Yeah, exactly. No. New naming something maybe what already is there, in other words, will not create a big change, right? Mm-hmm. And I also agree about the balance. It's like you need to find a balance in everything, in your lifestyle, in whatever you do, right? Mm-hmm. So the balance is really important. Let me just quickly take a quote from one of our person who is listening to us, because he made an interesting comment about climate change. He says that we can revert it when you know what the causes are. It is not only the emission of CO2, but also the destruction of the natural air conditioning by large-scale deforestation. And he says that if we don't know what causes it, we won't see the solution, restoring nature. So I'm curious to know more about that. If we reforest the whole planet, maybe indeed the climate change could be reverted. But now let's go to some tricky questions which I prepared for you guys, and this would be about regulations. And to be more precise, what do you think of the potential weaknesses of present regulations in financial system, and how it impact which impact it has on impact investment?
Well, I think I think we are regulations are necessary, but I think we are in the financial system, we are quite overregulated, and I think the danger out of that is, first, is inefficiency. Secondly, that which might also be quite good, that there is an innovation going on different channels, maybe not going through the traditional financial systems, going directly, because people want to find certain solutions which are still legal, but which are different. And this is what I meant also in the beginning. There will be huge changes in the financial systems, and many of the regulations are there to preserve a status quo. And a status quo preserved by regulations never lasts very long, and brings down. So I think there will always be try to immediately to regulate something, and regulations, I see it neutral. It's it can be good or it can be bad. And I see it also a little bit like President Reagan, who said the view of government on the economy is, and they said if it goes well, you regulate it. If it continues to go well, you tax it. And then if it goes wrong, you subsidize it.
That's a great one. That's a great one, Michael.
You have to write them all down.
But what about financial regulation in Switzerland, FINMA, right? So they have certain regulations which actually restrict financial players, banks, to put more impact investing funds in their product offering, right? Because it just restrictive, it's not supportive in Switzerland, unfortunately, compared to some other countries like UK. What would you say, like, how can we overcome these restrictions, even though it's very clearly everyone sees that, also sees government want to be more sustainable, but they are pointing to each other, Swiss government and FINMA, okay, who takes the step first? How can we resolve this issue?
You know, I think our society is in a trap of trying to avoid any risks. And the regulator itself is also a poor guy, because on one side, he should see that the system runs. On the other side, he has to make sure that nothing goes wrong, which is something which is a contradiction per se. And so I think if we don't accept that things can go wrong, we will always be in this problem. And I think this needs really broader discussions in the society and political discussions to get this these things right. Because if something goes wrong, the poor FINMA will be blamed terribly. But that doesn't mean that I'm a friend of I'm very much against too many regulations, and I'm not an anarchist, but I'm more a libertarian. But but I have to see also this problem, and I'm afraid the system of having regulators, and which we need, obviously we need them, but having regulators who are extremely strict and want to regulate everything, and unfortunately it will go on. But markets always find solutions and move. Problem is only when we have the OECD who wants to regulate everything on a global basis.
I mean, that would be very long.
We would be much better off than try having an institution which wants to regulate everything globally.
Absolutely. And then we would need to wait till it's finally globally regulated. I think it's very long processes. Yeah. We don't have enough time for that. And what do you think about this question on regulation?
I think I fully agree to
Ben. Can
Prince
you hear
Michael.
Me?
Yeah, I hear you perfectly. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So what I wanted to
yes, now I hear you again. Yes.
Oh, something went wrong. Okay. No, I
yes.
fully completely
somehow
you agree.
Can, yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah, I fully, completely agree to Prince Michael what he said. And I also have a very balanced view on regulation. The one potential weakness, as usual, I've tried to find the weaknesses in everything, of the present regulation system is that, especially with people like Larry Fink from BlackRock and everybody coming and saying green is good, that we are going to see a sudden movement of wealth in the to the green sector. And this can, if not properly regulated or controlled, this can lead to a subprime kind of situation, because so much money starts moving to a one direction, it will start feeding into bad equities or weak equities and maybe green branding, which can, I don't know if you remember very well the mortgage bond explosion we had between 1980 and 2008. So in this matter, I believe regulations are important and they should be put to place, because the ESG sector is growing and it's growing too fast. I mean, the last I read in the global wealth of 110 trillion USD, the global asset being managed by Credit Suisse said that nearly 40% has some kind of link to ESG consideration, and it's increasing fast. So I just hope, again, I mean, I'm looking again into the weakness of the structure, that if the regulations are not put into place, we can, the green movement can create also kind of subprime situation. And that, I think, is one of the weaknesses.
I would agree. You know, here we see also that some regulations which incentivize actors also in impact investing to take certain actions are very positive, right? If we could provide incentives, tax incentives for investors, if they invest in impact investment, then I'm sure there would be much more capital flowing into those funds than otherwise. Right, so regulation can be supportive also for impact investment. As we are talking about wealth, there is another question from the audience about personal wealth and fortune. So the question is, personal wealth, fortune is not only about skills, but also about luck. Yeah, some people are lucky to get a few million from their parents or grandfather. So is it fair to redistribute luck through tax systems?
Should I start this time?
Someone is missing a fortune.
I'll try to quote one of my favorite authors.
Start,
I already started. I'll try to quote one of my favorite authors, Aldous Huxley. I don't know if you know him. He wrote the book The Brave New World quite a long time back. He said, how can man make man equal if God didn't make man equal? So to redistribute luck using tax system, I think... Maybe Marx tried it. I'd like to hear Michael's view on this. I don't think it will work. It will create irritations and problems from both sides.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think basically the tax system shouldn't be really used only also for distribution. First, it should be used to pay the necessary expenses for the public. And this is one side. And on the other side, what you know when you earn something, whether it's through skill or through luck.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Okay, I hope your answer satisfies our audience. Let's get a bit more serious again. And a question about disinvestment. So, Michael, are you considering also disinvestment like Rockefeller's do or Norwegian oil fund or also impact sustainability reporting of the investment portfolio of your clients, for example, to integrate that?
I think...
Michael,
first, I
can
didn't
you hear
quite
me?
Understand yourself. Can you repeat the question?
Svetlana, can you hear us?
Hello. Can you hear me?
I think the question she asked was, are you considering disinvestment like Rockefeller's or Norwegian oil fund for impact sustainability reporting on the investment portfolio of your clients? So I think she meant your company, industry, and finance control.
But we don't do asset management.
Okay.
We don't do proper portfolio management. And I think, we have our standards, but when I look at things, I have my standards, which I think is good or bad. It's long-term standards, but I don't think I use systems like, let's say, the Norwegian Oil Fund would do.
Mm-hmm.
But we are mostly concerned with active companies of our businesses of the families we are making for, and these are given ones, so it's not really an investment business which I have.
I'm so back. I don't know, my computer was overwhelmed by all these questions, I guess. Could you hear my last question about disinvestment?
Answered it also. Answered about his organization that they don't do asset management. They do mainly advising the clients.
Advising the client, and they have the existing businesses. It's more on structuring that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, but then maybe going back a little bit to financial sector, how can financial sector support impact investment? Because I'm sure you have also a lot of your colleagues, friends, whatever, in the financial sector, what do they say? Is it possible that financial sector in Switzerland would transform, when it's going to transform, and be more sustainable, be more into impact investment?
Well, I think it does, and it happens, because they want to invest, and there are more and more also of that. Banks or institutional ones who are looking for impact investments. Mm-hmm. Some doing strong. There's a trend going there, and I think it will also happen by necessity, because the economy is transforming for all sorts of different reasons. New technologies, also a climate, changes in the society, and that needs adaptation. And I think we will get a much more bigger focus in the future on innovation and small and medium-sized companies than just the very large public companies. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's a trend, but these trends take always some time.
Right.
Because it needs a rethinking.
Yeah. Ben, how do you see that?
I think I agree to what Michael is saying, but I think it does need a nudge, the financial sector, once in a while. Because I have a very strong opinion about the financial sector.
Tell us. Tell us. The strong opinions are welcome here.
So I think in the last few decades, the financial sector has changed. It used to be a service provider to real economy and society, and now it has become a very dominating and profit-seeking sector. If I watch the old films, one of the main activity of a bank was to lend money to small businesses, medium businesses. We are talking mainly about the SMEs. But today we have a sort of shadow banking with financial institutions, equity funds, trusts, and investment funds. And then came insurance, pension, and real estate. So we have now even the fintech is in their hand. So they are using this power. This sector determines where the investments are going, who the lenders are going to be, and where the loans are going to be created. And these changes didn't just appear from one day to another. They have been gradual changes through many years. Laws, accounting rules, institutions, etc., have changed. And there hasn't been too much social discussions about this. And I also saw, because I was busy with this sector, that a lot of laws from US has been greedily adopted by the EU, without the politicians, all the unions, all the bureaucrats really understanding the long-term consequences of these laws. And banks are still the lenders to businesses, but their earning models have changed. Their earning model seems to be now have finally fundamentally shifted to speculative financial products and non-productive, credits. And it is now the shareholders who are determining the policies now, and not the credit rating of the loan or of the lending process. And this has impacted the business, where the primary goal of the business used to be to make more innovation, make better products. And now the business is thinking about how to pay back his lender all the time, which is often the bank or a private equity organization. So here I agree to Michael when he says that unlimited money printing through credit without a clear goal or political or social control does not do well. But on the other hand, I seem to have this kind of feeling that politicians have lost control or any idea of the financial world. I come from Netherlands, which is a very, very vibrant democracy with a very powerful and very advanced financial sector. But Netherlands is soon facing an election, and I was going through the party programs, which I always do before the voting comes. Not one party mentions the financial system or the financial sector, what they plan to do or what their policies are about that. So there may be, I see it as two reasons. Either the politicians have become too lazy to give it over to the financial sector, or they are too scared to take on such a powerful lobby. So as long, in my opinion, as long as this sector is not tamed or brought under control, the social inequalities will keep on increasing, climate change will not be attended to, and social development will suffer. And at the end of the day, it's always the citizens who have to take the loss. Sorry for this long monologue. So this was my idea about the financial sector.
Yeah. Michael, do you have anything to comment on that?
No, I think I would rather agree with that.
All right. Yes. I take another question from the audience, because as we were talking about small businesses, and here is a question to you, Michael. How is the Vaduz Technopark coming up? Are you inviting startups at Liechtenstein to work and develop global startups?
The Technopark, I haven't seen that, but I think it is doing pretty well. there were a lot of startups coming. And you know, the good thing is that there we don't mind if somebody also does not succeed. They have an opportunity to start. And we all know that it might not be necessarily the success. And that's why it's good that there's an infrastructure there, so that there, it doesn't need big investments for somebody trying to do some business there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So basically anyone can join the Technopark.
I don't know what exactly the rules are, but I think it is pretty easy.
Pretty easy. Okay, that's great. Okay, we are running out of time. We still have some minutes. I want to give you an opportunity to ask a few questions, or one question from Ben to Michael and one question from Michael to Ben, to round up. What do you want to know from each other based on our conversation or challenge, little challenge from you guys?
Michael, go ahead.
Should I go ahead? Okay, but I think where we have a bit the difference was on the future outlook and how critical it is, and you know, and I wanted to ask you, do you think and you seem very convinced that it is so. You know, I've seen many things. I've seen the Club of Rome, where they say that. I have seen already many sort of disaster scenarios which didn't happen, and we have certain specimens who disappear. There are certain specimens who grow. And I think we are also in a period of a pretty quick changes now. Do you think we can stop that?
I believe that if we really put our heart into it and all of us act on it, yes, we can still stop it and turn it. I mean, it was very coincidentally yesterday I was speaking about this example of one man in India who has created, I don't know, 168,000 acres of forest or something. So there are initiatives like this going on where people are turning things around. And I travel a lot. I mean, I have seen the reports in the Arctic, in the deserts of Africa. I have seen how India has gone down. I mean, and how Netherlands have gone down. So people of our age, at least of my age, we have seen this gradual movement of the gradual decline of our biosphere. And that worries me, because I think that's what generally I do. I see how the trend is and I speculate. I try to calculate, taking more variables in calculation, how it would be or what is the potential result we are heading for. And that worries me, because if I look at how we have done the last 30, 40 years, and this potential, and this can be changed and has to be changed. Otherwise, the next generation has a serious problem. And you also know that I'm also on the board of CLC, which is the biggest business organization of Europe, the Climate Leadership Coalition. Yeah, Climate Leadership Coalition. And they're working together with 24 or 27 universities in Europe. And plus with the ESA, because they are getting all the data from the ESA. So I think it's a severe, but it still can be stopped and changed. And the best part is that most of these effects or impacts we are creating is non-essential. It is not that we need to cut down the Amazon forest because we need that ground. It's not essential at all. Or we need to wipe out all the ocean floors or completely destroy the marine life because we need the shark fins. So none of these are essential activities which we are doing. So these can be very easily be replaced. And that's, I think, the positive side of the story, that all the alternatives exist. It is just a matter of changing the mind and saying, okay, I stop eating shark fish and I move on to something else. Or I stop destroying the Brazil forest to grow cows, but I do something kind of reforestry where you can use the land without destroying the ancient forest, you can use the existing land to produce income, which is far higher than raising cattle, because that is one of the main reasons why they are destroying the forest there. And it's completely not making any sense. The farmers or the people there can make much more money with the same land doing something else. And there is enough alternatives for that. For example, paper industry or forest farming and things like that. You don't need to destroy the ancient forest.
And so I may add here just little thing. I know, Michael, maybe you've seen some videos when during COVID, when people were not going out to the streets, nature was taking over. You know, you've seen elephants walking on the street, tigers, monkeys. So nature can restore if we just give it some time and leave the nature in peace, right? So we are, then it can restore by itself. Even.
Yeah, I think that's why I'm also less alarmed than bandits.
That's true, but we have to give nature the space.
Ben, you have an opportunity, very short question to Michael, and then we need to close the session, even though I would like to continue with you guys, but we need to close soon.
So Michael, what do you think about the financial movement? So like we discussed about the green movement and the Wall Street and all that, do you think this is just a kind of bubble being created, or do you think that really the financial movement or the financial sector has had a change of heart and is really going to act on it?
I don't know. I think the financial sector is not adapting and says there's a pressure there and says we have to go in this direction. The danger is, and you said it before, that we are creating again a bubble. Mm-hmm. Where I disagree maybe in this point with you is that I think we will not control that by rather by the market than by regulations. Because all the bubbles in the past were rather created by wrong regulations than by the markets. Mm-hmm. So I think we are in danger of that it's going too far. It is right that the financial sector recognizes that, but it might go too far, and it might also become too bureaucratic.
Okay. Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much for coming and joining us today. It was a real pleasure, very interesting conversation. I hope you will join us another time. In 10 years, for example, so we can see if the predictions of you two were right. So, or of course, keep in touch with you, and thanks a lot for coming. Thank you, Ben, also for taking the challenge and taking the chance to speak about your opinions.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you, Michael.
And I hope to see you before the 10 years are over.
No, absolutely.
Thank you.
Of course. Bye, Michael. Bye-bye. And for our audience, just a little announcement for the next week. So next week, our speaker will be Martin Palmer, who is the chairman of Fate Invest. For our regular viewers, he was actually supposed to be in week 4 with us, but because of technical issues, he couldn't join. So now it's finally happening. So next week, we have Martin Palmer with us. And looking forward to that.
Yeah. And just to point that for those who are not aware, Fate Invest is one of the largest investment group in the world, if not the largest. So, and under the leadership of people like Martin, are fast moving also into impact investment sector. So next week you will hear why, how, and where they're investing. See you then. Bye-bye.
Thus act with impact. Bye-bye. See you next week.
Bye.
Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good.
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing and how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.